Yes.
Hey, I'm Jake Brennan, and I want to tell you about Disgraceland, the award-winning music and true crime podcast that I host. Disgraceland tells the stories of musicians getting away with murder and behaving very badly. Fleetwood Mac, Nipsey Hussle, Cardi B, Ozzy Osbourne, Taylor Swift, Tupac, The Beatles, Amy Winehouse, Jay-Z, The Grateful Dead, and so many more. This is not the music history you've heard before. This is an uncensored, immersive look at the lives of musical icons as seen through the crimes they've committed or that have been perpetrated against them. Did Jerry Lee Lewis murder his fifth wife? What really happened to Sam Cooke in that seedy motel at 3 a.m.? And how did the Rolling Stones wind up sleeping with the First Lady? Wait, what? New episodes of Disgraceland drop every Tuesday with bonus episodes released on Mondays and Thursdays. So get in, buckle up, and join me in Disgraceland. Available right now, wherever you get your podcasts. Rock and roll.
About a Girl is a production of iHeartRadio and Double Elvis. You know about Tupac Shakur, the legendary and influential rapper whose work spoke to issues facing the inner cities of America and who is mythologized by his untimely murder. But this is not about Tupac Shakur. This is about the woman he loved, who was at his side when he died, the daughter of a music legend herself, Kidada Jones. This story is about a girl. When Kidada Jones was 20, LL Cool J dumped her. They'd been pretty serious. He'd bought her a ring and everything. But he was a nice Christian boy from Queens, and she was the kind of chick who thought nothing of going to the ashram for the weekend to have a guru brush her face with a peacock feather. She was too new age for him, he would say later. 100% LA. And he was right about that. Kidada had grown up breathing some pretty rarefied California air. Her mother was the actress Peggy Lipton, who'd starred on the Mod Squad in the late 60s and early 70s, and her dad was Quincy Jones, a legendary jazz musician, bandleader, and composer, and now one of the biggest producers in pop music. Kidada was used to celebrities like Michael Jackson dropping by her house for dinner, so getting dumped by LL Cool J didn't really faze her much. As for the New Age spirituality, she came by that naturally, too. Peggy had started bringing Kidada and her sister Rashida along to her guru's meditation sessions when they were just little kids. They would put their heads in their mother's lap and fall asleep while she chanted mantras. But even as privileged rich kids, the sisters' childhoods were not quite identical. Rashida, with her straight hair and green eyes, took after Peggy, who was white. Kidada's darker skin and curlier hair made her look more like Quincy, who was black. Their parents had hoped being biracial would be easy for their kids. It wasn't. White people often presumed Rashida was white and thought nothing of saying racist things about black people around her. Or they'd interrogate her about her ethnicity. What are you? When she told them, they might react skeptically or they'd be apologetic. It was confusing and painful. But Kidada may have had it worse. At the overwhelmingly white private school their mother had enrolled them in, the other kids called Kidada things like chocolate bar. She had dyslexia, but the teachers interpreted her learning difficulties as an attitude problem. She could sense their lowered expectations for her, just as she could always sense some subtle disapproval from her white grandparents. Pretty soon, she really did have an attitude problem. She later insisted on switching to a majority black school where she didn't tell the other kids that her mom was white. When their parents divorced, Rashida went to live with Peggy. Kidada stayed with Quincy. All of this baggage made both sisters pretty sensitive on the topic of their family's racial makeup, even after they grew up and became adults. And so, in 1993, when a rapper named Tupac Shakur had the nerve to talk shit about their father in Source magazine, they were pretty pissed. Tupac was blowing up at the time. He was about to drop his second album, and he just appeared in his first movie. Blessed with an almost feminine beauty, he had to work hard to project the masculinity and hardness required in hip-hop. Now that included dissing people you didn't even know, like the Jones family. "Quincy Jones is disgusting," he said to The Source. "All he does is stick his dick in white bitches and make fucked up kids." It was true that Quincy had a type, and that type was pale and blonde. He had 7 children in all, by 5 different women, all of them white. And it was true that Rashida and Kidada had both struggled with their interracial identities in different ways. That said, Tupac was talking way, way out of turn. It was Rashida who publicly called him out in an open letter printed in The Source. "Where the hell," she asked, "would Tupac be if people like Quincy Jones hadn't paved the way for him to even have an opportunity to express himself? I don't see you fighting for your race," she wrote. "In my opinion, you're destroying it and shitting all over your people." Whatever Kidada thought of Tupac's words, she kept it to herself. She had other things going on. Kidada had always had a strong sense of fashion and design. In high school, she paired Doc Marten boots with one of her dad's tuxedo jackets, or a baggy sweatsuit with door knocker earrings. In 1983, she was studying at the Los Angeles Fashion Institute for designing and merchandising, but she dropped out after she was recruited by Tommy Hilfiger to be a stylist for his new brand, Tommy Jeans. Kidada would become Hilfiger's muse. Under her guidance, the brand shed its preppy rep and instead became the ubiquitous street fashion brand of the 1990s. The sporty, tomboyish looks Kidada had honed as a teenager became the Hilfiger look. Baggy jeans, bandeau tops, oversized jackets in primary colors. It was a look with urban swagger and feminine charm all at once, and it became what every female hip-hop head wanted to wear. Kidada even met her best friend, the singer Aaliyah, at one of Hilfiger's fashion shoots. The two became inseparable, and Aaliyah would wear anything Kidada picked out. Kidada had a similar amount of trust placed in her by Michael Jackson. She'd known him since she was a kid. And in 1995, she styled the King of Pop in Tommy streetwear for a cover shoot with her father's magazine, Vibe. Then one night in New York, not long, actually, after LL Cool J dumped her, Kidada was partying in a club when someone told her that Tupac was in the building. It had been over a year since his Source interview and Rashida's clapback, but you don't forget that kind of thing. Kidada hoped she wouldn't run into him. No such luck. The rapper was heading straight toward her. It turned out someone had told him she was Quincy Jones' daughter, and he assumed they meant Rashida. He was there to apologize. "I want you to know that I didn't mean all that about your dad or you," he said. "I didn't see you as human beings, but now I see you." He sure did. In fact, he was straight up checking her out. His apology was probably at least one-third pickup line. But he also seemed sincere, disarmingly so. As if all his emotions were right at the surface, brimming over. And Pac was really an extraordinarily beautiful man. Glowing skin, a sensual mouth, big brown eyes and eyelashes that went on for days. The whole time he was apologizing to her, Kidada kept thinking, "Oh my god, he's so cute." They hung out a few times after that. Kidada's father found out and told her she was absolutely not allowed to date Tupac Shakur. "This is one rapper you will not be bringing home." But soon afterwards, Tupac and Kidada were having dinner at Jerry's Deli in L.A. when Quincy happened to walk in. He spotted them together and came up to Tupac from behind. Quincy clapped both hands down on Tupac's shoulders, making him jump. Hey, Puck. We gotta kick it. I have a few things to say to you. Tupac and Quincy sequestered themselves in a booth. Kidada watched them talk. She was too far away to hear what they were saying, but she saw them end the talk with a hug. After that, Tupac and Quincy were cool. Tupac's apology had been accepted. Even Rashida was won over as soon as she actually met him in person. She was at Harvard, and she wound up interviewing him and writing a paper on him for class. Tupac was so unguarded and curious, it was impossible not to like him immediately. It seemed hard to reconcile this man whose warmth and intelligence were so obvious with the man who talked shit about their family. But that was Tupac all over. He was always balanced between extremes. He'd been homeless as a child, but he'd also gone to an elite arts high school where he'd studied literature and ballet. He loved Kate Bush and Mozart, was hip to Shakespeare and Victor Hugo, but he also positioned himself as a revolutionary black artist in the tradition of his mother, who'd been a member of the Black Panther Party. Even his lyrics were contradictory. On the same album that contained his feminist anthem, Keep Your Head Up, he dropped bars dedicated to his own prowess as a womanizer. In fact, Tupac's relationships with women could be toxic. Not long after he apologized to Kidada, he stood trial for sexual assault. He was convicted and served 9 months in prison. While there, he married another girl he'd been seeing, Keisha Morris, but he didn't even mention her when he gave a jailhouse interview to a reporter, and the marriage was annulled less than a year later. That reporter, incidentally, was writing for Vibe, Quincy Jones's magazine. Apologizing had been a good move for Tupac. In the interview, Pac said he wanted prison to be a turning point. He finally had time to think clearly, without the haze of pot or alcohol, which had both become problems for him. He told the Vibe reporter about the woman he'd hurt. Though he denied being present for the alleged sexual assault, he felt responsible for not better protecting his accuser. He talked about how it felt when he'd been shot in a robbery the year before, and how he thought he'd been set up by friends of his. Biggie Smalls, Puff Daddy, and others. I don't have no fear of death, he told the Vibe reporter. My whole life is going to be about saving somebody. I gotta represent life. The masculine posturing he'd worked so hard on had gotten him nothing. When you do rap albums, you gotta train yourself. You gotta constantly be in character. That was part of why he'd gone so hard on Quincy in the Source interview. He'd been trying to be tough. He was done with that. He wanted to be who he was. Contradictory, artistic, sensitive, visionary, political, all at once. When he got out, he swore, I'm going to show people my true intentions and my true heart. He was in prison less than a year before Suge Knight, co-founder and CEO of Death Row Records, paid $1.4 million to bail him out. Knight was a shady character, menacing and incongruous with Tupac's desire for change. But it was his only escape route. In return for Knight's investment, Tupac signed a 3-album deal with Death Row. It was October 1985, and he was a free man. He set out immediately to make his aspirations a reality. And his first move was to realign himself with Kidada Jones, to build a new life together. First, poems started arriving at her house. A new poem every day, each one accompanied by a rose. Tupac was a prolific poet. He wrote poems like other people breathed, and it was his way of courting a girl who meant something to him. But for Kidada, who'd looked so long for a black identity and community, Tupac's political philosophy might have been even more important than his poetic skills. Tupac was always inventing acronyms, and he lived by the one he tattooed across his belly, Thug Life. The hate you give little infants fucks everybody. It was a recognition of the damage racism does to black people from birth, and a defiant promise to rise anyway, even otherwise privileged black people, like Kidada. In Tupac, she'd found someone who understood the pain she'd felt all her life, who understood that it was bigger than just a teacher's disapproval or a grandparent's distance. In Kidada, Tupac found someone who got him, who he was and who he was trying to be, allowed for his extremes, and loved him unconditionally for it all. By the spring of 1996, she had moved in with him. They lived on an estate in the suburbs, leased for them by Death Row Records. They were rarely there alone. Pac's mom, sister, and nieces often came by for extended visits. The estate was also a home base for a rap group Tupac had assembled after prison, comprising a group of younger cousins, play cousins, childhood friends, and godbrothers. They were mostly teenagers. Tupac would lecture them regularly on the rules of life, as if he were their dad. He was making plans to start his own label when he was out from his Death Row contract, to marry Kidada and move out of L.A. He and Kidada were talking about having their own kids someday. It was something she'd always fantasized about with her BFF, Aaliyah. Getting married in a double wedding, having their kids play together, and now it seemed like Tupac shared that dream. Kidada got a tattoo of his beautiful face on her shoulder. Tupac wasn't entirely a kinder, gentler version of himself, though. He wrote a brutal diss track against Biggie Smalls, bragging that he'd screwed Biggie's wife. It was vicious. Some around him were worried it would cause more trouble. That spring, Vibe editor Carla Radford was setting up the magazine's yearly expedition to Milan, Italy, for Fashion Week. The magazine usually participated and covered the event, and Radford had gotten a call from Gianni Versace asking if Tupac could walk the runway for him. Tupac didn't have a current passport. He'd been out of the country before, but only on tours and never to Europe. Although he was known for his eclectic style sensibility, the high fashion world of runways and fittings was something he knew nothing about. He was hesitant to commit. It was a world Kidada knew well, one she'd become totally familiar with through her work with Hilfiger. She convinced him of how big an opportunity this could be for him. It might open up a new dimension to his public persona, another step toward the person they both knew he could become. So in June, they boarded a plane and flew to Milan. Tupac was used to being a huge star in the US, but he hadn't realized that Italians were hip-hop heads too. When he saw the crowd of fans there to greet him at his hotel, he was, as Radford put it, shook. Milan itself dazzled him. At every fashion show he went to, he was scheduled for 12 in 2 days. The designers wanted him to sit in the front row and wanted to dress him afterwards in their garments. They loved his beauty. They loved his eyelashes. He walked the runway for Versace wearing a golden velvet suit. Kidada was at his side in a gauzy red dress. They looked like the royalty of some long-lost nation. It was a moment he might have never had if not for Kidada. It was one of the last best times of his life. In September, Tupac had planned to go to Las Vegas for the weekend to watch Mike Tyson's boxing match and perform at a club afterwards. He and Tyson were tight, and he'd written a new song, Wrote the Glory, for Tyson to play as he walked to the ring. He was going to debut it at the fight. Suge Knight, the head of Death Row Records, and Tupac's cousin Jamala came too. His bodyguard, Frank Alexander, was also there, along with a few other Death Row associates. Kidada had a bad feeling about the trip, like they weren't meant to go. A conjure lady in Tupac's family had called her earlier, and she'd had a vision that Tupac would settle in Vegas. What did that mean? Vegas wasn't in their plans. The fight was on September 7th, a Saturday night. Kidada and Jamala stayed at the hotel while Tupac and Suge went to watch the fight. Tupac told her the night was just for the boys. Can you believe they brought us out here and they don't want us to be with them? Jamala said. Kidada just shrugged. The night passed by slowly. Tupac and the boys eventually came back to the hotel to change before heading to the club. Kidada had been supposed to go with him, but he told her it was too dangerous. There'd been a fight between him and a member of a rival gang in the MGM lobby. I did a 1-2 on a dude. I knocked him out. He kissed her and left. A few hours later, they got a call. Tupac had been shot on their way to the club where he was set to play. "I'm sure he's all right," Kidada thought. He'd been shot before. She wondered where he'd been hit. The arm? The leg? Would he need stitches? But at the hospital, they handed her a bag. Inside was the clothing and jewelry Pac had been wearing when she'd last seen him. All of it was covered in blood. They told her he was hanging by a thread. But he had a 50% chance of survival. "I'm dying," he'd said on the stretcher. But he had been conscious when he got to the hospital. Doctors had to put him in a medically induced coma because he kept trying to get out of his bed. His lung had to be surgically removed. Kidada called her mother, who dropped everything and booked a seat on the next flight from New York to Vegas. Then she called her father. "Can't come," he said. "My love is with you." "What?" Kidada was still in shock. She couldn't process the anger and frustration she felt. In the hospital, her mother held her. Tupac's family was already there, and when they stood in a circle to pray to Jesus for his life, Kidada's white, Jewish, New Age mother stood and prayed with them. She prayed with Tupac's conjure lady cousin, too, both of them trying to save his life through spiritual means. Kidada never thought she'd see these two worlds collide, but in the hospital room, with Tupac at the edge of death, the distance between Tupac's mother, Afeni, the Black Panther warrior, and her own mother, the actress, didn't seem so great. It was September 13th, 6 days after Tupac was first shot. He hadn't yet been woken from his coma, and it was all blending together. People were coming in and out. It hurt Kidada to see him in so much pain. She had an idea of what might help. A specific CD of a specific song. That afternoon, Don McLean's voice was in the hospital room, singing about starry nights in a soft voice that seemed the furthest cry from the music and the image Tupac had made his living on. But it was his favorite song. Tupac had always felt a connection to Vincent van Gogh, and to him, the song captured the painter's spirit perfectly. That was when Kidada thought she heard a moan. She looked up at Tupac's face. His eyes were open, but it was horribly wrong. They were filled with mucus and swollen. She moved close to him. "Tupac, do you hear me?" She thought, though she wasn't sure, that he nodded. "If you can hear me, move your feet." His feet moved. She took his hand. Kidada wasn't sure what was happening, if he was getting better or worse, but either way, she wanted him to know. "Do you know I love you?" He nodded. "Do you know we all love you?" He nodded again. Then he started convulsing. She had to leave the room. His mother was waiting. Kidada knew the two of them ought to be together. It was Afeni who made the decision to take him off life support. It was 4:03 p.m. when he was declared dead. He was 25. Kidada was only 22. But in that moment, her world stopped. For a long time, she wished she had died too. In the aftermath of his death, rumors started to fly about what had happened that weekend in Vegas. There was talk it was a cover-up, a fake-out. People pointed fingers. A lot of them pointed at Biggie Smalls, Tupac's friend and professional rival. But 6 months later, Biggie was also murdered, in mysteriously similar circumstances. Suspects would be raised over the years, but no arrests would ever be made. Kidada didn't listen to any of it. She lay in bed, flat on her back, as if she were laid out for a funeral herself. Afeni had scattered Pac's ashes in a park in L.A., but Kidada couldn't believe he was gone. They'd lived together only 4 months. 4 months out of what should have been a lifetime. Tupac was the first of three profound losses Kidada would sustain. The second was her best friend, Aaliyah, who died in a plane crash in 2001. Then in 2019, her mother, Peggy, died of the cancer she'd been battling off and on for 15 years. But Kidada had a strong foundation. She wrote a book, School of Awake, a guide for adolescent girls who might be struggling with school and identity the way she'd struggled. She wrote down the calming techniques she'd learned, some new age, some not. Her resiliency kept her going, and she wanted to share that gift with others. Sometime in the 2000s, Kidada had her shoulder tattoo of Tupac covered with a rose. She was criticized for this. A lot of Tupac's fans and his friends had never liked her. She was stuck up, they said. She was rude. But it didn't matter what anyone thought. What she and Tupac had was beautiful and real. He was the love of her life, she told reporters. But life moves on. She'd forgive her father for his brush-off when Tupac was in the hospital. She'd later come to understand that he'd taken Pac's death hard, that he'd come to love him like a son. 25 years after his death, Tupac Shakur remains one of the most influential rappers of all time. His profound lyricism and his aspirational evolution as a person and artist changed the game and inspired a generation. It's impossible not to hear his music in every rapper who came after. But this isn't about them. This is about Kidada Jones, who loved Tupac, inspired him to transcend his beginnings, and believed in who he could become and the life that they could have had together. This is about a girl. About a Girl comes to you from Double Elvis and is executive produced by Jake Brennan and Brady Sadler. It was created, written, and narrated by me, Eleanor Wells, with additional writing and editing by S.I. Rosenbaum. Scott Janovitz is the show's producer and mixer, and provides music and editorial support. Audio editing by Matt Tahaney. If you liked the show, please subscribe to About a Girl on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. And be sure to leave a rating and review. For more great shows from Double Elvis, visit doubleelvis.com. That's doubleelvis.com.